You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
According to the editors of Scientific American, the great question of all questions at the present day is, how can we best turn to account the natural forces which are in play about us? If that phrasing sounds a little strange, well, it's because it was written in 1883. For more than 100 years, scientists and engineers have been trying to find reliable alternative sources of energy, and today they seem to be closer than ever. In a new book called Renewable, The World-Changing Power of Alternative Energy, science writer Jeremy Shearer delves into the history of solar and wind energy along with hydropower and biofuels to find out how each of them could play a role in our future. It's published by St. Martin's Press, and I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Shearer to our show today. Hello.
Thank you for having me.
Is it inevitable that we'll have to turn to renewable energy as the supply of fossil fuels dwindles?
I believe that it is. Fossil fuels are finite, as we all know. They may last for a while longer. It could be 50 years. In the case of oil, it could be a couple hundred years.
But we seem to be awash in them right now.
We do, but the more of them that we find, the more we tend to use. These fossil fuels get used up very quickly. Inevitably, we'll have to shift.
We continue to debate the nuclear energy alternative, which has been damaged by a number of accidents like Chernobyl and Fukushima. Critics are also concerned about the storage problem, but yet there are some people who insist that that is the only alternative.
You know, when I started writing the book, I was skeptical on that score. But having come out the other side, I personally believe that nuclear does have a role to play. It's certainly not a perfect solution. There are problems not only with storage, but with the proliferation of weapons, of course. And yet, I think that nuclear does have a future and does have a role to play in the energy future.
You write that this book started when you bought a new car. Why did that decision suddenly become so complicated for you and your wife?
Well, yeah, it was funny. You know, when we bought our first car ever, there was only one choice. You just got a car and you put gasoline in it and you go. You know, we got a Honda Accord. But by the time we got another car, suddenly there was something called a hybrid vehicle. And so I had to look into that as I wanted to be responsible, and we looked into it. And that really opened my eyes. You know, what is a hybrid car? What does it matter? And that really set me on the path towards writing this book.
And you decided not to get a hybrid?
We decided not to get a hybrid mainly because we really don't drive all that much. I live in a small town, and there's not – so it just didn't make sense money-wise, although I support the idea of hybrid cars, certainly.
Well, if you drive a lot, hybrids are a problem as well, aren't they? If you're going to do a lot of highway driving, the electric charge only lasts so long, and then you're back to driving on fossil fuels.
That's true. And not only that, but I think what a lot of people don't realize is that the electricity that you put into a hybrid vehicle comes from burning coal, from a coal-burning power plant. So you're still consuming fossil fuels even if you're driving a hybrid car.
As you did the research for this book, were you surprised to find out just how far back the history of biofuels, solar, wind, hydro, and geothermal energy actually goes back?
I was surprised and fascinated.
Like that Scientific American statement, they were already worrying about these things 100 years ago?
Absolutely. Even a couple centuries ago.
Well, actually 130 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, from the very first moment that oil began to be produced in this country in a commercial way, right literally the very next day, newspapers started worrying about and speculating, how long is this stuff going to last? So this debate about fossil fuels and renewables has been with us for a very long time.
And we had Henry Ford coming up with a car that didn't use fossil fuels. Why didn't that experiment last?
Well, actually, one of the people to blame for why we put gasoline in our cars rather than alcohol made from plants is none other than Abraham Lincoln, believe it or not. And I can tell you that story. It's a fascinating story. Back during the Civil War, to fund the war, Lincoln put a tax on all alcohol. And it's a tax that lasted into the 20th century, right around the time that Henry Ford and others were mass-producing cars. And so it was very – and there was a debate at the time. What should we put in these cars? How should they run? Should it be gasoline made from oil Or, as Henry Ford actually preferred, should it be alcohol made from plants? And it was not a settled question at all. But the problem was this tax that Abraham Lincoln had instituted was still on the books, and alcohol was simply too expensive, largely due to that tax.
But once the tax was lifted and alcohol became inexpensive, why didn't anybody go back to it? I mean, we understand why the Stanley Steamer didn't survive. Mm-hmm. But alcohol would have worked, wouldn't it?
You know, it would have worked. And it, of course, it still works today. The reason it was too late, cars were being mass produced in greater and greater numbers, and the engines were designed to run on gasoline, not on alcohol.
One of the issues with each source of renewable energy that you discuss in the book is that it has drawbacks to its production. Is there any fuel out there, green, renewable, or otherwise, that doesn't have serious drawbacks?
There's no free lunch. No. Every source of energy has some cost. But if you compare the costs of, say, building and implementing solar panels to the environmental costs of burning coal and using up oil without ceasing at all, I think that you have to come down on the side of renewables.
On the other hand, aren't we a bit more skeptical and wary of the potential of these alternative fuels today than earlier scientists and researchers were?
How so?
Well, because everybody was talking about them as the answer to all of our problems, and now every time this kind of topic comes up, somebody says, oh, yes, but.
Well, you know, back in the 1970s, which was the last time there was a real burgeoning interest in renewables, I think that there was this sort of utopian vision that, you know, everybody will have solar panels. Jimmy Carter very famously put solar panels on the White House. I write about this in the book, and there was a big initiative to make solar the main source.
And he said at the time, a generation from now, this solar heater can either be a curiosity, a museum piece, an example of a road not taken, or it can be a small part of one of the greatest and most exciting adventures ever undertaken by the American people.
And guess what? His solar panels in the White House did, in fact, end up in a museum. They were removed by Ronald Reagan as soon as Reagan got into office. But I think today—
Was that a political decision?
Absolutely.
Or were they inefficient?
He was sticking it to Jimmy Carter. Absolutely. The panels worked. He was sticking it to Jimmy Carter. But I think that today, based on my discussions with many of the scientists I spoke with for the book, I think people are much more realistic today. The technologies have really advanced, and it's clear to people who study this stuff, there's no magic bullet. It's going to take a grouping of renewable technologies.
Clinton didn't put them back on, Obama?
No, they haven't done that.
Now, one of the problem with solar panels is that they're really expensive to produce. Germany, which relies a lot on solar power, would probably not if the government wasn't subsidizing their production.
That is true. However, it's important to note that the cost of producing solar panels has come down significantly just in the past few years, and it continues to come down as they're being mass-produced.
So would you say solar is the best approach so far?
I think solar is very, very promising and has come a really long way. I think right now, though, probably wind power is the most established and most successful of the renewables.
Although I just heard a report on NPR yesterday, I think, in which it was pointed out that a nuclear power plant takes up, I don't know how many acres, but not all that much. But the wind power takes up thousands of acres to produce the same amount of electricity.
Yeah, that's true, and that is a concern. However, if you ever go to visit a wind farm, as I did, I write about this in the book, when I go to West Texas to visit wind farms there, you'll see that it's possible to incorporate wind farms into a farmer's fields without completely obliterating everything else around it. So there are ways to create these power plants in a sustainable way.
On the other hand, people who are near some of the wind farms, when they are near where people live, have complained about all sorts of things, such as it's made their homes and their lives much worse. There are concerns about wildlife being affected and even maimed by the blades of the turbines. Birds are losing their wings. Others say that they're noisy and an eyesore. So it's rather controversial. And you found it, interestingly, in Massachusetts, where there was a plan to put up a whole big wind farm, that liberals and conservatives all were joining together to oppose them.
Yes.
The Kennedys and the Koch brothers.
Yes, it's true. In very strange ways, there are small but very vocal groups of people who sometimes protest things like wind farms. As far as wind turbines creating a sort of noise that can drive people crazy, there's some anecdotal stories about that, but there is no hard evidence that that actually occurs.
Well, there was a film, a documentary, in which they showed not only the noise, but also a strobe effect that upset a lot of people.
So the anecdotal evidence would have it, but I've talked to scientists who've done studies, looked into this problem, and they haven't found the effects. I can say personally, when I went to Texas, I stood directly beneath a 200-foot-tall turbine, and the blades were spinning at top speed. I didn't hear a thing.
Now, if you go to Palm Springs and look at that wind farm, half of the windmills aren't operating. Others are spinning madly, and mm-hmm. some are just sitting there. So they aren't always so efficient.
Well, you know, when if you drive by a wind farm, you'll often see that. Some are spinning, some aren't. Why is that? It's often the case that some turbines are shut down for maintenance. It's sometimes the case that they don't want to pump too much electricity into the grid, so they purposely shut some down. What I can say is that wind is pretty much by far the most advanced of these technologies. These machines really work well.
So that is, as far as you're concerned, the best approach to alternative? I mean, obviously, water is probably the most efficient, but we just don't have enough hydropower to compete?
I wouldn't say that wind is the single best. There's no one technology that's going to solve all of our problems. It's really an aggregate. Together, wind is a proven technology. I think it's the most advanced. Solar is coming right up behind. We've had hydropower ever for quite a long time, but there are some really amazing new advances in hydropower, such as wave energy, capturing the energy of waves, that has great promise.
So people who live along coastlines might very well benefit. People in the middle of the country might not.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
My guest is science writer Jeremy Scherer, S-H-E-R-E. His book, Renewable, The World-Changing Power of Alternative Energy, is published by St. Martin's Press. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Jeremy Scherer, who's a science writer, and his latest book is Renewable, The World-Changing Power of Alternative Energy. It is published by St. Martin's Press. When we talk about ethanol, many of us imagine fields of corn being grown to create biofuel, and a listener has written in, Anderson in Manhattan, who asks about the land use involved in raising the corn, sugar, or plants to produce ethanol. Is there any way around that?
That is an excellent point, and it is a serious problem. It takes a huge amount of corn and a huge amount of land to create enough ethanol to really put a dent in our use of fossil fuels. This is something that many of the scientists I spoke with are still struggling with, but one way that they're trying to deal with it is to come up with alternatives to corn that don't need quite as much land.
Things like non-edible plants like kudzu or switchgrass,
mm-hmm.
because people also concerned that ethanol was causing food prices to rise.
Yes, that's right. And there's some evidence that that wasn't, in fact, the case.
Isn't a certain amount of energy required to make ethanol in a way counterbalancing the benefits?
Yes. I mean, it absolutely is. There's no free lunch here. It takes energy to do just about anything. And that's why I was fascinated to learn that doing something like coming up with a new crop, let's grow Chinese silvergrass instead of corn, well, it's not so easy. You have to figure out how to grow it, where to plant it, how to harvest it, and to make it sustainable so that you're not creating more problems for the environment than you're solving.
It seems that wars have shaped the development of the energy industry greatly. Kerosene got a major boost over alcohol because of those taxes you mentioned earlier during the Civil War. The start of World War I effectively ended an experiment to create a solar power plant in Egypt.
Tell
me about that before we go on to some of the other things.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite stories from the book. There was a guy from Philadelphia named Frank Schumann, who was kind of an Edison-like figure, who his great dream was to create a kind of solar engine that could replace fossil fuels. And this is back in the early 20th century. And he built a successful working steam solar plant in Egypt, and it worked, and it was poised to revolutionize the Egyptian economy. And then World War I happened, and it blew his dream to bits.
And then people don't pick up these projects later?
You know, one of the problems is that he was just a single person. He was just starting to get the backing. The German government, in fact, was really interested. Governments were starting to be interested. But he was just a single guy, and then the war comes, and everything falls apart.
And he was being backed by the wrong country, the country that wound up losing the war.
Well, that's right. And as you mentioned, during World War I, I mean, that's the first war where you have airplanes and trucks, and those were powered by gasoline, and that gave a real boost to the oil business.
Have wars ever produced any advancement for renewable energies?
Yes, actually, in very interesting ways. In World War II, there were some very important advances in aeronautics. And so after World War II, wind turbine technology really began to develop, because before that, there was very little known about how things move through the air. Something like an airplane propeller is very similar in how it works to the blade of a turbine. So there were many scientists who, because of what they worked on during World War II, were able to apply that after the war to wind technology.
Drew in Colorado called in to let us know that in the Netherlands, they've developed bladeless wind turbines. I don't know if you've heard about those.
I actually haven't. That sounds fascinating.
And another listener says that solar panels were finally installed over the White House this summer.
Ah, yes, that's right. Not the same panels that Carter once used, but President Obama did, in fact, install his own solar panels.
Well, we mentioned earlier that Germany has actually, the government itself has been subsidizing solar panels. Mm-hmm. How important is government policy in encouraging the growth of alternative energy industries?
I think it is absolutely crucial. We're talking about if renewables are really going to take hold, they are going to have to compete with the oil business, with fossil fuels. And this is a business that from the get-go has had huge government support.
Well, two of the strongest economies in the world are Germany and China, and they are putting money behind it. Why is the United States lagging behind? Is it just a political matter? Like Ronald Reagan taking the solar panels off of the White House?
I believe that's right. I believe it is largely a political matter. That's not to say that there aren't legitimate concerns, but I think politics plays a huge role in why we don't have the kind of policies other countries do.
But policies can take the form of tax breaks, which many opponents usually like.
That's right, and tax breaks can be very effective, but they have to be stable. So what's happened in the past is that you'd have one administration instituting incentives or tax breaks for wind farm developers, for example, but there would be limits to them, and these developers would know that they could go away. And so it creates this instability that's not conducive.
And then regulation is another way to encourage this sort of thing, and regulation right now is a dirty word in this country.
Well, that's right. That's right.
Now, what about what's happening in China and Germany, their investment in solar energy? Can we learn anything from what they're doing?
Well, that sort of remains to be seen. I mean, if you look, take China, for example. China is working sort of pell-mell. They're just going full steam ahead with all kinds of energy projects, not only solar and wind, but also nuclear and coal and all sorts of things. I think that in a way, there are some things we can learn not to do from China.
Well, China, of course, has major pollution problems, not just in Beijing, but I just saw some film footage from Shanghai where you could not see your hand in front of your face.
Yes.
Worse than London used to be.
That's right. So China has real incentive to develop these renewable technologies. But one problem with the way that China at least has in the past done this is that they've rushed ahead with creating these giant wind farms but hadn't thought through, well, how are we going to get the electricity to where people actually need it? That's a pretty big problem, something you should think about beforehand.
You compare visits to coal-fired and solar-powered plants. What was the coal-fired plant like?
That was one of the most fascinating things I was able to see. The coal, walking into a coal power plant is like going back in time. It's like walking into a time machine. In our digital age, everything is very clean and silent. And you walk into a coal power plant and it's loud and dirty and dark and it's impressive. You cannot help but be awed by the sheer mechanical power of such a place.
Why dirty? Because of coal dust?
Exactly. I remember walking down a staircase at one point, and I just instinctively reached out to steady myself on the handrail. And when I pulled my hand away, it was completely black with coal dust.
And then they have these chimneys that are spewing what looks like really toxic stuff.
Yeah,
and people in the areas don't complain?
Well, you know, there's a reason why coal power plants tend to be placed in places where people don't live. You don't want to live near a coal power plant for that very reason.
Although eastern states are now complaining to midwestern states about the fact that all of that pollution drifts over to us.
Well, that's right. And that's, you know, one of the problems with fossil fuels, as is well known. They're putting stuff in the air that's a real problem.
Where was the solar plant that you visited?
I visited a few different ones. I visited one at the Denver International Airport. That was very interesting. I think airports are places that are ripe for the development of solar farms.
It was very clean, you're saying.
Yeah. One thing that was great is the day that I visited the plant, it was a huge snowstorm. Or it was the day after. So the day before, there'd been like a foot of snow drops in the Denver area. So I'm trekking up to my knees in snow, walking around these solar panels, and they're making electricity, and it's absolutely silent. The panels are just these sort of futuristic-looking flat black slabs, and it's really amazing to think these things are actually making electricity.
My guest is Jeremy Scheer, S-H-E-R-E. His book, Renewable, The World-Changing Power of Alternative Energy. It's published by St. Martin's Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, the materials that go into making solar panels are plentiful. Why is it so expensive to produce them?
It's the same reason that computers used to be very, very expensive to make and to buy. Over the years, we've figured out how to make them more cheaply and faster. It's really the same reason. The cost of solar panels has come way, way down over the past few years. So solar panel makers are getting better all the time at mass producing them.
But we seem to have problems with producing things that also will be efficient. Another is lithium batteries. I'm not sure I understand why, after all the years of working on this kind of technology, we're still facing problems.
It sort of depends how you look at it. You know, you look at something like lithium batteries, or you look at something like solar panels, and you say, okay, they're 20% efficient, the average solar panel. They take only 20% of the light that hits them gets converted. So you could ask, well, why? Why can't it be more? It will be more in the future, but if you look at it, it used to be only 3% back in the day. Now it's 20%. That's a huge advancement.
Is infrastructure a major issue?
Where energy is concerned, infrastructure is always a major issue.
Well, didn't fossil fuels have to face the same problem in the early 20th century?
They did, except that they weren't competing against an already established energy system. They built it from scratch.
And Standard Oil built up its infrastructure and delivery system during World War I when it was considered a necessity.
That's absolutely true, and they had significant government backing.
Is efficiency a major concern for all these renewable energy sources?
Yes.
I mean, how much power do they produce?
It is a central concern. How much power a given renewable energy source produces depends on that depends on the source. So, for example, solar power, most panels, like as I said, are about 20% efficient, meaning that at their peak, they can convert about 20% of the sunlight into energy. But they're becoming more efficient all the time.
Well, the fantasy would be to have a car that would have solar panels on its roof, and
right.
we'd be able to run that way. But right now, that would be impossible.
Right now, that's not happening. But I really do believe we're going to see that. I believe we're going to see in the future houses with roofs made out of solar panels.
Renewable energy technology seems to be changing quite quickly. And just because just a few years ago, when you were looking to buy a car, electric cars, except for the $50,000 Tesla, which is now, I think, $70,000 or $80,000,
yeah.
Weren't really on the market. Now we have several. Better wind forecasting is helping that technology. Solar panels are becoming more efficient. Does that fast pace of change make customers hesitant to invest in any new technology? Because then you have to pick.
That's right. I think that people like investors can be wary of investing in new energy technologies. But on the flip side, there are many funds out there and a growing number of funds that are, in fact, investing in renewable energy technologies because they're becoming better investments all the time.
Joe asks on our show page, geothermal seems to make much sense to me. Are the obstacles technical? Is it more difficult than it seems, or are we just slow to change our thinking?
Yes. All of the above.
It's a lot easier in a place like Iceland than mm-hmm. here because the stuff is coming right out of the ground whether you try to tap it or not.
That's right. So we're in a place where like Northern California or in Iceland where you have steam vents just coming out of the ground, it's pretty simple. You trap the steam and use it to spin turbines, you have electricity. But if you drill down deep enough into the earth pretty much anywhere, you will eventually hit hot rocks. And the trick is, how do you use that heat to produce energy? Well, you have to pump water down there, and then you have to bring the steam back up. That's a technology that was really started to be developed in the 1970s. It works. It's not as advanced as something like wind or solar.
And then we have the problem of water shortages in many parts of the country.
Well, that's right. And that's a problem both in the fossil fuel industry and for something like geothermal.
Because in an effort to become more energy independent, we're also seeing increased investment in fossil fuel sources like hydrofracking in the Northeast and natural mm-hmm. gas production in Canada and the Plain States. And hydrofracking requires a lot of water, doesn't it?
It requires a tremendous amount of water. And one of the problems is what to do with that wastewater once it's been pumped back out.
And nobody's come up with a reasonable answer because that wastewater is pretty much polluted.
It is highly polluted. And no one has really come up with a very solid answer yet. It's a problem.
Well, we had a lot more talk about renewable energy when gas prices were over $4 a gallon for in the New York area. Now they've gone down again. Does that mean that suddenly people are less concerned?
I think the average person on the street probably yes, but the scientists working on these technologies, you know, tend to take the longer view.
Well, we had the problem where in the 70s, where prices really went up because of that OPEC situation, mm-hmm. And there was a lot of talk about change. Now we don't hear much again.
That's right. I mean, that's, you know, there's historical precedent here. The moment that gasoline prices shoot up significantly, suddenly people are interested in hybrids and things like that. But that's taking the short view.
Can we also do hybrids involving renewable sources, like somehow mix solar with wind or gas?
Yes. I think that the dream for electric vehicles is to have electric vehicles that use energy that's created using the sun and the wind rather than burning coal.
After writing this book, I'm getting a sense that the energy source you think probably holds the most promise, at least for the near future, is turbines. Am I correct?
I think so, but only insofar as that's the technology that's been the most advanced. The turbines have reached a point where they've kind of been perfected. But I think that something like wave energy, which is much in a much earlier stage of development, but it's fascinating and it has great promise.
And where would you put those? I guess that's hydroelectric power plants. Would we be putting them like 30 or 40 miles offshore?
Well, that's one idea. So some of the scientists I spoke with, there's a lot of activity in Scotland in particular, and they're experimenting. And like, so for example, off the coast of Oregon in the United States, there has been a lot of activity, a lot of experimental activity in trying out new wave power technologies.
I would think Hawaii would be a really good place to try this.
Not only because they have a lot of waves, but they import all their oil, and its energy there is hugely expensive.
Jeremy Shear's book, Renewable, The World-Changing Power of Alternative Energy, is published by St. Martin's Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having me.